Today is July 1st, 1994, and my name is Natalie Peters. I'm here with Harry and Alan, and we're going to talk about Harford County history. Can we start with what brought you to Harford County originally, and what year was that?
Well, I came to Harford County in August of 1945, actually the day that the peace was signed for the Pacific War. Housing was at a premium then because the war was, of course, winding down. The town of Aberdeen was filled with soldiers and a lot of scientists and research people had moved there. Housing had been literally thrown up. And if you are familiar with Baldwin Manor and Swan Meadows, and there was another one that was on the grounds of the Proving Ground that was mercifully taken down. But we moved, were married in June the 30th, as a matter of fact, moved there in August into Baldwin Manor. And I have recollections of Baldwin Manor that I don't think I'll ever forget. We did not get into one of the apartments. Now, they were very elite. They had a two-burner hot plate to cook on. We moved into one of the houses, cinder block houses. We had a cook stove, and my poor new husband had to eat food in two conditions, half raw or burned, because I could not use that cook stove. And we had a potbelly stove. You know what a potbelly stove is, or brown, burned wood and coal in it, that heated the house. There was a cinder block wall between the living room and bedroom, and a wallboard wall between our bedroom and our neighbor's bedroom, which I think was more or less cardboard. So that was my introduction to Aberdeen. My husband worked at the Proving Ground, and I went to teaching at Aberdeen High School. And at that time, Aberdeen High School was on Route 40. Again, I have a lot of fun, happy memories there.
Can you tell me about some of them?
Yes. If you taught in the front of the building, facing Route 40, you had to contend with the screeching brakes as they stopped for the traffic light and the whistles from the Pennsylvania Railroad, because they did not have the overhead at that time, and it was a grade crossing. Terrible accidents were there lots of times. So the engineers would blow their whistles furiously, and it seemed to me a train was going by every 2 minutes. Fortunately, I had a loud, booming voice and would try to talk over them. Then if you taught in the back of the building, you were facing the playground of the teams. That wasn't bad. And the B&O tracks were on down a block or two, and they were not difficult to cope with. And Aberdeen High School at that time was not accredited by Middle States. And while we were still housed at the Aberdeen High School, we went through our first accreditation. And we had a very small room that we called our faculty room, very small, and a table in the middle, which wasn't very long. We decided we would paint that table to make it look as nice as possible, because that's where our visiting team would do their paperwork. And unfortunately, the paint didn't get dry, and we were in there on Monday morning trying to take the paint off so they could work on it. The team went through our building. The new high school was being built up on Paradise Road, and they accredited us conditionally that we would get moved, and as soon as we were moved in, I guess the next fall, they came back and looked over our new facilities, and we were accredited and have been ever since.
Now, what would be the difference between a high school that was not accredited and one that was, as far as the students were concerned?
Well, our curriculum didn't change. We had a good curriculum and we were a good school. It's just that if a high school or a college is accredited by one of the six accrediting associations in the United States, they have passed muster, so to speak, so that their students are accepted at other places without difficulty. When we moved into the school on Paradise Road, I really thought that was the alpha and omega after having taught in down in on the Route 40. And of course, schools were needed. Halls Crossroads was built because when I first started to teach from 1945 until whenever that building, Halls Crossroads, we had from grades 1, no kindergarten, to grade 11. Always said we were smarter in those days. And it was a couple of years, I don't remember the time, when it was decreed that we would have 12 years of schooling. And they began back at, I think it was the 7th grade, and worked in the extra grades so that the youngsters that were in the 11th grade didn't have to go an extra year, but they started in the 7th grade and worked through so that that class then came up to the 12th grade and had 12 years. And we were so crowded when Halls Crossroads school was built, still crowded, and they had to, or maybe that was before, I'm not sure of my time frame, but I know that they had school in some of the buildings in Baldwin Manor, and they were sort of a barracks type thing. And I recall a friend of mine who taught there and said that you could hear the other teacher very plainly, and she said her youngsters were not doing something that they should have been. The other teacher was bawling her class out, and she said all she did was stand quietly, and then she said, and that goes for you too. That was the year, believe it or not, she had 50 fifth graders. 50! And when they had an epidemic of measles, she said she had to keep looking to see if the children were working because it was so quiet when she'd say, get your books out. It was like the thundering herd when 50 youngsters got their books out. When they, so many were absent, it was quieter. And then I'm talking a lot about Aberdeen because that's where we lived and for many years. And my contacts, Aberdeen had beautiful old homes. Maybe you've seen some of the pictures of the beautiful, beautiful old homes that were there, and they've been torn down now, and banks are on the corners. But those homes were the really the centerpiece of Aberdeen. And I guess Aberdeen was a pretty provincial town. And my husband and I, I'll tell a little story. If you want to cut this story, that's all right.
No, I want to hear the whole story.
But they were very provincial, and they weren't used to all these foreigners sort of invading their town. Of course, we weren't there when the Proving Ground came, but we've heard the stories of how distressed people were when the Proving Ground came and took over farmland, and little did they know how much farmland would go for houses in the next generation. And so then when all these people began to move in to work at the Proving Ground, particularly when the war came, it disturbed people. And the church that we went to was Grove Presbyterian Church. Otto Gruber was the minister at that time, and we went in, and there were man and his wife that were always rather friendly to us. And then I realized that we were getting a very cold good morning. So finally I ventured to ask somebody, I said, why do you think Mrs. So-and-so is not talking to me? Because I can't think of anything they did. And this woman patted me on the shoulder and said, Harriet, you're sitting in their seat, and that upsets them. So the next Sunday, we got there early so we could be sure to sit in the same pew, but down. And when this lady came in, she sat beside me, and she patted my knee, and she said, it's so nice to have your own seat to sit in. And we were friends ever after. I just didn't sit in that seat. My recollection, early recollection of Aberdeen and Harford County is that very rural. The canning factory in Aberdeen was still operating.
Can you give us a visual picture of that?
Well, it was on the other side of the Pennsylvania tracks, and I can't give you too good a picture of it, I don't think, but I know that it employed people. They canned
local people?
Corn, yes, there were local people there. And a lot of the corn was grown on farms right around. And down in Perryman, I guess the Mitchell farm raised a lot of corn. But I don't think they canned it. I think it came up to the Osborne canning house.
By wagon or by train or?
Oh no, it would have come up by a wagon, I would think, because it was close enough that it would have been trucked in, maybe by truck then, because they wouldn't have brought it up by horse and wagon. They would have brought it up in a truck, I should imagine, big trucks. And it was canned. And of course, that has been closed now for many, many years. During the war, and again, we got there at the tail end, the people were opening their homes to soldiers. In the summertime, I've heard friends say that if they went out to sit on the porch, and they all had porches then, there would be people come by and say, my mother or my wife or my girlfriend is coming for the weekend. Would you have a room that they could have while they're here? And they set up at the USO, have a housing bureau, so that people gave their names that they would take soldiers in and or their wives. And I think a lot of fast friends were made during that time when people were there. Our school system was very small then, and I guess Dr. Wright, I guess, was the superintendent the first year.
Milton Wright.
Maybe the second year.
And did you know him?
No. Not, I had seen, but I really did not know him. And then Dr. Willis followed him and was superintendent for many years. And he was, I think, a moving force as the communities grew. He was the moving force in getting buildings, school buildings built, and curriculum changed and so on. But we would go to the Bel Air High School, but before preschool meetings. And those were the days when we dressed to the nines. We wore our hats and gloves to those meetings. And we didn't begin to fill the auditorium at the what was then the old, I guess it was the high school that's there now. Gosh, it's so long, I've forgotten some of this. But I know we didn't begin to fill that auditorium. And then times began to grow, population began to come in, and every year we filled it a little more until one year Dr. Willis said, this is probably the last year we're going to be able to meet in this fashion. And by then, a lot of high schools had been built, and eventually we moved to having just regional meetings at different places and at different times. Aberdeen had a lot of restaurants because the population there needed them. But my recollection is that Bel Air did not have restaurants. The only one I can remember, there was an old hotel there where I think the old Safeway was built. And there was a dining room in that hotel. When we would go for our meetings, I think that's where we would eat, or else they'd have to drive away. Now, I think my memory's serving me right. And Bel Air was very rural. It was this county seat, but it was a little country town in 1945. Aberdeen was still sort of country, but it was had forced upon it some more suburban type atmosphere. But I remember Taring's hardware store still closed for an hour at noontime and Wednesday afternoons. You had to have your schedule right.
And they closed so the employees could go have lunch or something?
Yes, I was going to go home. And the A&P and Acme were side by side on that street next to where the post office is. And you would go in and people would wait on you. And then they built new Acme's new A&P. But that was the day when we didn't have a car for a while. And we bought our first home, and so we still didn't have this car. But we could walk. We could walk to church, and we walked to the grocery store. And my husband had been raised in White Plains and in New York and lived in apartments. And he just thought it was heaven on earth to walk downtown. And, to send him for a loaf of bread, you just knew he wasn't going to be back for a while. Because when he'd come back, he'd say, "Oh, Harriet, I met so-and-so, and I met so-and-so, and it's so wonderful to meet people, and they know you, and you talk to them." And that was his idea of a little piece of heaven, to have people know you. And that was fun.
And this is at the end of the war.
So this is the end of the war. End of June of 1945 and on.
Was your husband in the military?
Well, he had been in the war, but he was a civilian when he came back.
Stationed at Aberdeen.
He had been stationed at Aberdeen for a while before the war, before he went overseas. Then he came back to work as a civilian. He was discharged from the Army when he got back from overseas and came to the proving ground. So that then there was this transition time when soldiers were going home, but still there were a lot of military around for a good while, a long time. And then, of course, I lived there long enough to see the proving ground change in character, so that the research was still going on, but the numbers of people declined. And then housing, while there were areas built in Aberdeen, areas in Bel Air began to grow, and people from the proving ground moved. They commuted from Aberdeen to Bel Air and areas of Harford County to work. Of course, even during the war, there was some commuting for a lot of people. But after the war, I think then is when we see Bel Air come into its own as a thriving area, because people began to want to move out of what was rather crowded and compact in Aberdeen then. So they wanted to move to other areas. And now when I drive around and see this sea of houses and can remember, oh, that was a beautiful old farm, and that was a beautiful farm, it's a little heart-rendering, really. Gee, I can't think of anything else to say.
Well, tell me now, you said a character of the Proving Grounds changed. Did the atmosphere of the sort of friendliness that your husband appreciated so much, did that change as well?
Well, no, I don't think so. But maybe we then, by that time, were such a part of it that we didn't see it if it changed. It didn't seem to me that it changed. It seemed to me people were still very friendly, and I think they still are. I think Harford County tends to be a very friendly area where people take you in and care for you. And then when we moved to Churchville, we moved our membership to the Churchville Presbyterian Church. And I have just wonderful, wonderful memories of that area. And friendliness is the key word. It was when we moved out there, I guess it was 1967 when we moved to Churchville. And Churchville was still a country community and still a lot of farms. We lived in Rolling Green, which had been a farm. And there was a farm across the road, which has now been developed as Priestford Hills. But our church was still had the characteristics of a country church. And no one was a stranger in that church. And I don't think they are yet. I think people are still very friendly. But there were a lot of older people there. And they could talk to us and tell us about the Finney family and Dr. Finney and the people that had gone there. They were stories that were told to us. And the church then began to grow and change as the community changed. As a matter of fact, the minister that was there at that time, Gene Stambaugh, was just a dear country minister and had done a lot to help build the church. And then I think it was such a tribute to his devotion to his work that he began to see that the trend was to a more cosmopolitan group of people, people that were in research and development and business. They weren't just the farmers and so on. And he said, it's my time to leave now and turn this over to somebody who can handle this kind of a population. And we all hate to see him go, but I think he felt that he was not qualified. And he went to an area, I think in Pennsylvania, and had two rural churches and was happy there. And our church has changed. We still have some farmers there. But we do have a lot of people who are employed in Baltimore, at the Proving Ground and various other places. So that gives you an idea of how the community has changed.
How did that impact the congregation? Or did it?
Well, the people who had been there accepted those of us who came, and we loved those who were there. It was a wonderful fellowship and caring. There were people who came there with PhDs and, you know, all these research and things that I wouldn't understand if they talked to me. And people who were farmers, and they could talk and relate to each other and socialize and have a good time. That is Churchville. And I think that's still Churchville with the people. Diverse careers, but a caring population. Now, I'll talk a little bit about Churchville, the way it was when we moved up there. And this is the way it had been. The Kohl's store was on the corner. And of course, Margaret Kohl still lives there. And that was a delightful store to go into. It was a real country store. You could buy anything from a coal bucket to your pasteurized milk and all things in between. And it was just a nice, chatty atmosphere. And then next to the church was this lovely old home that's now kind of a little mini mall, you know. Of course, the Kohl's implement place was there. And I'm trying to remember what was on the corner where the Crown Station is now. It wasn't the Crown Station, that's for sure. Probably just a building of some sort.
You're talking about the corner of 136.
136 and 22. And then where the bank is now, I don't know what was there, but it wasn't a bank. Maybe it was just a vacant lot. I really can't remember. But when we moved there, that what was now the Citgo station, that was a filling station. But it was just rural. It was country. There was no traffic light, and you really didn't need one right then.
What were the roads like? Were they paved?
Oh, yes. The 136 was paved.
They weren't tar and chip or anything?
No. They were paved. But we'd have big snowstorms then. And I remember one snowstorm when they could just get one lane of traffic, one lane open through, and kind of had to take your life in your hands to go down there, and school would be closed for a whole week at a time because we couldn't get school buses in. And then, of course, things gradually changed, and we got the bank, and we got the service stations, and we got the telephone office, little building there that houses equipment. And our church was then eventually put on the National Historical Registry. And the beautiful trees that were in the churchyard, they were elms, and of course they got that blight and we've lost many of them. But they were so beautiful, and it was just a joy to drive past and see that lovely setting. And my whole bearing, though, even when we moved to Churchville, because we both worked in Aberdeen, Bel Air was not a focal point for us. After I retired, Bel Air became a focal point, and by that time, that had grown to almost what it is now with buildings. And I remember when the Harco Credit Union started in the basement of, I can't think of the lady's name. She's still head of Harco. Oh, it'll come to me when you go home. But they had Harco Credit Union in their basement for a long time. And then finally it moved to the house on the corner where it is now. Then that house was torn down and they put up a building, and now they're doubling it in size again. And the library grew. And, well, that's something I could tell you about in Aberdeen. There was no library.
A little bit of a lead, and that should be okay. You're saying Mrs. Baker
yes,
in Aberdeen.
Yes, Mrs. Baker in Aberdeen, one of the Baker families, had a little library on the second floor of a building on the corner of Law Park and Bel Air Avenue. And I don't know where the books came from, because there was no central library at that time, and you could go up and borrow books.
And what year was that about, again?
Well, this was 1945 when I moved there, and very limited. And then...
Did she sign them out just like a regular
library? Yes, we signed them out, it seemed to me. And I can't remember. The town supported that library? I don't know. I just remember that we'd go up there and get books at a very limited amount, of course. And then gradually the library system for Maryland took over, and we have our nice libraries today, but that's the way it was then. I'm jumping around a lot. But
that's what we want to do. Do you remember Mrs. Baker's first name or her husband's name?
Not any longer, I don't. I can remember, I can see her in my mind's eye. A very attractive lady. But I was thinking, as I talked about the library, of the street of Aberdeen. From Route 40, moving up toward the B&O tracks. I can't tell you all the buildings, but on one side, a town office building wasn't there at that time, but I can't remember what was there. And then the bank, and I'm trying to think what that was. Moving up, we had the bank, and that was that First National? What was that bank called? It was a bank that was in Baltimore, and that's all been gone through different changes now. Became Equitable, originally, finally. And then on that street, I think Dell's drugstore was still there. Much different character, little drugstore, but I don't remember whether they had a soda fountain or not. And then on up a little farther was this marvelous bakery, Gull's Bakery. Very fine German family. Not Gull, that's not the name. I have Gull's and Harry Grace. The lady lived for a long, long time, and just delightful German lady, and she made the best cheesecake I ever ate. I'll never find a piece of cheesecake that good. And we would go in there and indulge, and those were the days when you could eat all we wanted at the show. Then on beyond that bakery was a garage, and sold cars and repaired cars, and that went right up to the corner. And then on beyond, maybe the firehouse was there then. And then some beautiful big old homes went on up that street. And on the other side of the street, again back at Route 40, moving up, there was some kind of a lodge there on the corner. And Tearing's Hardware store. And then I don't know. Then I guess the A&P and the Acme probably filled in there. And the post office. And then my recollection is that there were more lovely homes. The Methodist Church was there at the corner of Park and Bel Air Avenue. The Methodist Church, then the homes, and then a Lutheran church at the corner of Law Street and Bel Air Avenue. That was Lutheran Church. And then you got into, I think there was a some kind of a repair shop. Maybe it was for automobiles or something. And then on up to the B&O tracks. And as I said, my husband and I didn't have a car for a long time, and B&O was our favorite way of traveling. Ralph's mother still lived in New York, and we would ride the Royal Blue to New York. And if we wanted to go to Baltimore, we would ride the train. Now, there was a little Singerly, is that what that was called? But it was sort of a local. It stopped at every little crossing. I mean, people got kind of out and flag it down. And it took a long time to get to Baltimore on that, because sometimes you'd have to sit on the siding while a train went by quickly. But we would sometimes ride that into Baltimore, or one of the other trains that went straight through. And we'd go into Baltimore to do our shopping on Lexington and, you know, those streets in there where the four stores were.
Shopping for clothing, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, furniture and all kinds of things we'd go to Baltimore to do. Mm-hmm. Because there just wasn't that much. This didn't seem to me, in my recollection, that there was. Anyway, we all went to Baltimore to shop. That was a big outing, you know, to go to Baltimore. And again, you wore your hat and gloves.
And if you purchased a piece of furniture, they would deliver it?
Oh, yes. And then Hutzler's and Hochul's and Stewart's, they had their own delivery trucks, and they would deliver to your door the things that you purchased.
Even clothing?
Oh, yes, clothing, yes. Yes. Go and get something, and then it would be delivered to you. And that was nice, because when you were traveling on the train, it wasn't all that great to carry so many packages. And of course, the Greyhound and Trailway both went through Aberdeen at that time. And I think maybe the Trailway went into Bel Air. I'm not certain. And as I said, my focal point was Bel Air. But we ladies would sometimes get together and have shopping sprees in Baltimore and eat in Hutzler's for lunch and come back.
Hutzler's is the place to eat.
Well, when you were shopping, you stopped at Hutzler's to eat your lunch. They had a delightful little restaurant, and go in and have lunch, separate and meet them for lunch, and talk about all the prize things we were buying.
But yeah. You didn't go there for their something specific like their cheesecake.
No, not like the. Oh, I wish I could remember the name of that lady.
Was it Schmidt?
No. Oh, dear, I wish I could remember her name. I should have asked somebody before you came, but I kind of couldn't get my thoughts together to what I wanted to say, and I'm still probably jumping around.
No, it's terrific. It's very good. Now, were there any other, I mean, not in a negative sense, but were there any people in the community that stood out in your mind, characters or leaders or anything like that in Aberdeen at that time?
Well, there were old families that were, I guess, had been the backbone of the community. Bakers, Mitchells, Umbargers, I guess Tarings. Those were four families I can think of, and they had businesses. And I think they were all, now Tarings, of course, they had the funeral home. That was back Park Street, little tiny, kind of almost like a hole in the wall, but not very big. Their funeral home, and then they had the hardware store. There were but three brothers, I think. I think they were brothers. And then they had these owned these pretty lovely homes. Bakers, I think, and Umbargers and Mitchells were in the farming part of the community with the big farms and the tanning factories and that kind of thing. So those were names of people, families, that were important to the, I guess, to the life of Aberdeen at that time. Now, I'm sorry.
You were talking about the families of Aberdeen?
Oh, yes. And this is another little church-related story. Annabelle Mitchell, and those are, they still live over toward Haverty Grace now. She and I co-chaired a supper. It was an oyster ham supper at the church that the women would put on. And it was a big operation. And I was sort of the gopher because Annabelle knew all about putting on a supper. I was kind of a young kid, so to speak, and I leaned on her. But anyway, we had this supper, and it was in the fall of the year, and one of the women from school bought tickets, and she and her husband came. But she said, and we had pies. That was dessert. And she said, Gene said he would like to come, but he wants to buy a pie. He had to leave right away. He had to come early because he was coaching some kind of a team. So I said, okay, I will make an extra pie, and he can buy that. It won't be in the count. So I told that to Annabelle, and she and I had that all worked out, that we got how many pies there were and all different varieties of pies, and I can't remember anymore what Gene wanted, but I made whatever it was he wanted, and that wasn't in the count. That was just an extra pie. But one of the ladies who hadn't lived in Aberdeen too many years, she wasn't, I think she was from Virginia maybe originally, anyway, saw me sell this pie to Gene, and later she came up to me and she said, you should not have let him have that pie. We may run out. And I tried to explain to her, but she just wouldn't listen. She kept on berating me about this pie. And so it really upset me because I was fairly new and I was young and I was really upset. So one of the ladies named Mrs. Mitchell, who, again, had been there for years and years and years, I guess I was sort of crying on her shoulder, and I said, oh, Mrs. So-and-so just bawled me out terribly about that, And I said, Annabelle and I had worked that out. And she put her arm around me and patted me and said, now, don't you worry about that, Harriet. We understand, and you did all right. And anyway, I've been here longer than she has, and don't you worry about it. So that gives you a little idea that you had a rank order there. Right.
She had seniority.
Huh? That's right. And I enjoyed that. And I guess our life sort of revolved around the church, and we had such good times, and we had a young married couples group. We called it the Omega, and we would meet once a month and have a supper. I can't remember whether we knew what the menu was and we each were to bring something to fill in, or whether it was strictly potluck. I can't remember anymore. But it was a lot of fun, and then we'd have some kind of entertainment or a speaker. And one of the things right after the war was to have someone from the Proving Ground come and explain to us, quote unquote, the atom bomb. And I'd get that at church, and I got it at the school PTAs, and I never did understand what it was, you know, but it was awesome. And then Mr. Umbarger, I think it was, would provide us with a banquet once a year. And we made that a thing of piece de la resistance, you know. I mean, it was everything. And what good times we would have. And it's fun to get out those old pictures and look at us all young and youthful and full of pep and ginger. And that was great. And as I said, life was, I think, simple then. You didn't mind walking up the street. If I had a meeting and it lasted until 9:30 or 9:45, I didn't think a thing about walking up the street
at night.
And even there were some soldiers around, but you just didn't think about it. They were all safe, and there was no problem.
And they were polite to you?
Yes, they were fine. I didn't often walk alone like that, but it was safe. You didn't worry about it.
How did you get involved in social work?
We meant the Department of Social Services? Well, I retired in 1983. I had been a school counselor. I might say that I stayed at Aberdeen High School from 1945 until 1983. As a teacher and then as a counselor. And I always laughed and said, I was a good training ground because Bill Loper was a counselor with me, and Al Seymour, and Bob McGee. So I always tease and say I trained them well to move up to bigger and better things. And when I retired in 1983, I wanted to do something. And I happened to be talking with a friend who said that his sister was working with juvenile services as a volunteer in Cecil County. Well, I thought, that isn't what I want, but maybe there's something in social services. So I called. And Margaret Deem was the coordinator for volunteers then. And she said, oh, sure, we could use her. Well, my name was a little bit known because social workers would come down to school if it was a matter of child abuse or something. And we did have those in those days, but not anything like you do today. They would come down and foster care so that while I didn't know a lot of people, I knew some that would come down, we'd work together. And I told her that I wanted the summer off, and then I would start in the fall. And I was a real eager beaver. I was afraid I would have 2 minutes on my hands. And I went down to Falston and Hospital and volunteered there starting in the fall for a couple of days. You see, I really was geared up to work. And during the summer, Margaret called and wanted to know how I would like to work with the director on a program, which I said, well, I'll give it a try. What is it? So I went in, and the federal government was phasing out CETA. Don't ask me to put a name to that acronym, but it was money that was used to help people get into jobs, and they were trained, but they hadn't been able to find a job, and so we used to get some of those CETA employees in our guidance office for a while, and there would be CETA workers at the social services. As a matter of fact, one of those CETA workers is now one of the supervisors. I mean, just was a marvelous thing for her. And so that CETA money was available, and the government made it available to states to be used for a homeless program. And the counties applied for the money. Harford County was given $24,000, but they didn't remember to put with that somebody to run the program. So Mr. Gardelli was casting about how he would run the program, and Margaret said she had a volunteer, and I always thought they were so brave to take me in, almost sight unseen. And that was the year, in November was the year that the social services moved into the new state office building. Up until that time, they were in Equitable Bank building. There was an office in Haverty Grace. They were scattered in little pockets all around. And I met Mr. Baradelli in the Equitable building, I believe it was, terrible, cramped quarters, and he told me what we needed, what he needed, and his words to me were, maybe you could write some directions for us, and I was aghast to think that I was being asked to write these and not have much background, but we talked it out, and I went home and wrote up some plans and took them in, and I always teased and said that was the easiest year because none of us knew what we were doing, and I didn't follow a lot of procedures, but it worked, and we got the money straight. And so then I stayed with that program for 7 years, but it was growing and getting very, very much larger, and so I said I would. The sixth year, I said, I'd do it one more year while they made decisions. And it was then that they hired, and again, I've forgotten her name, isn't that terrible, a delightful young lady, and moved her office to the housing agency, and she's a full-time employee now. But when I was doing this program, the first year, we could juggle the money around again because the money was there. They didn't have the same state regulations that came into being afterwards, but we had the $24,000, and we earmarked this much for homeless people and this much to pay rent. At that time, we paid a little bit on mortgages and a little bit and for food. And we got, we refined that as we went along, but I was, in that a very short time when I realized that at that point it wasn't homeless we needed, but it was money for rent. People were coming in with court evictions. And Mr. Baradelli was able to move money. He said, well, we'll take these many dollars and move it over for eviction. And it was an eye-opener to me because I saw the children of these families. But then I was seeing...
You mean when you were teaching?
When, yes, as a counselor, I would see children who would come in and I know that they were having financial difficulties in the family, but it soon became apparent to me that now I'm seeing the parents of these children who are, many of them working, parents who are falling through the cracks because they didn't have health insurance and they had old rickety cars that they had to have in repair because Harford County doesn't have that kind of a system for transportation. And they, so they had to use money to get the car fixed or else they couldn't get to work. And it was a matter of juggling. What do we do with this? You know? So then after that year, the state then had time to set up some guidelines, which made it much easier to go by because then we knew what we were doing. And but I soon used that $24,000. I think I started in November, and about February we'd used up that $24,000. And then that meant I was finished. And so I said, if there's something else I could do. So they said, well, sure, you could help with the fuel fund. And that was in the Department of Social Services at the time. And so I would see clients with that. And then the money ran out there, you know, as it does every year. And I said, well, now what do you want me to do? So they said, well, would you be willing to see people who are coming in with emergencies? They were some of the same people, that type people that came in when I had the shelter money. And so that evolved into seeing people who had court evictions, homeless, maybe without food, or they needed money to help bury somebody that was on public assistance, or their refrigerator broke down and they needed help with repairing that. So so then I just worked 2 days a week doing that. When the money came in the fall then for the homeless shelter program, I devoted my time to that until that was gone. And then we did, then from that point on, I did fuel fund and emergencies as they came.
You must have met a lot of interesting people in this time.
I did. I had a lot of interesting experiences because the county executive, is it Barringer, maybe, established a homeless shelter committee. And Mr. Berardelli asked me if I would be his designee, and went to that, and I met Joan Traub there, whom I have great respect for. She's a very capable woman, and tried to work up guidelines and bring some of this into perspective, because Harford County on the surface looks like such a prosperous county that it's difficult for people to believe that there are pockets of poverty, homelessness, and the working poor. They are almost hidden, the invisible problems in Harford County. But I must say that now that I'm down here in Baltimore County and working at the Department of Social Services, we see the same people, type people, with coming in. And now, and always you see people who are on public assistance coming in that maybe are having trouble managing their money and they're on Section 8 housing, and they come in for assistance. But my heart really bleeds for these working poor who just struggle constantly to make ends meet. You and I would have sleepless nights if we were in their same situation. And I, through this homeless program, I got into some of the regional state meetings, there was, it's still in existence, advocacy for homeless, I can't remember the name. Gee, I'm getting to think I'm getting old. Maybe I do belong in this old group, huh? But anyway, I was a part of that, and it was a state group, and Harford County was a part of it. I was the treasurer. This is always tickles me because I sometimes had trouble balancing my own checkbook, but when I would handle this homeless shelter money, I always kept my records and would go into the finance officer and we would check monthly and make sure we balanced, and we always came out to the penny. And then I was treasurer of this state group. And that was funny too, because again, somebody that always shied away from money, doing that. But that again, gave me a chance to meet people. A lady that, was in Baltimore, I think she was a state representative to the General Assembly, and I can't remember her name, and a man that's in the state legislature. Both of them are wonderful.
Stupid lead that it has in the beginning. There it goes.
And I got to know some of those people and develop great respect for the kind of work that they're doing and the things they're trying to accomplish. And I believe Harford County is becoming more aware of the needs, because we have the soup kitchen at the United Methodist Church, and the soup kitchens in Haverty Grace, and then the church, I think there are maybe three churches in Aberdeen. They have money that they pool and rent apartments and move maybe families or single parents in for a length of time and try to counsel with them and help them get work and get on their feet. And then the Episcopal Church in Churchville has the Holy Family House, and I believe now they had two apartments at the time I left Harford County. That was another fine thing where they, again, were doing somewhat the same thing, moving people in and trying to counsel with them and get them relocated permanently and move them out and make the apartment available to the next person in need. And the upper end of the county, shelter was opened for women. That was a worthwhile kind of thing. The Harford County Fuel Fund, I think, is another means of trying to help people, and that certainly is growing in recognition. And I got involved with that, again, through the Department of Social Services, and was on that board. Margaret Dean was on the board at the time and raised the point that we needed to make ourselves more visible, and maybe if we had a fundraiser, it could be helpful to make people understand us. And I read an article about people in Texas had chili dinners, and they so jokingly at a meeting, I said, I know what we ought to do. We ought to have a chili dinner to keep people from being chilly. And of course, she who opens her mouth gets the job. So that was the start of our chili dinners. And WMAR Television, which is one of the sponsors of Central Maryland, Fuel Fund Central Maryland, helped to get us posters. And the merchants in the community are wonderful about donating. And there's a black church kind of alliance, and all the black churches donate just fabulous donations to that dinner, and that is growing. I was told that at the last Fuel Fund chili dinner, which was held in January, I think they cleared $2,700. Wow. And the first one, I think we cleared $1,500, and we were ecstatic. So I do think that Harford County, again, that might be a change from what it was when I moved there to what it is now, that I know there were poor people there, but there weren't as many, and people weren't as concerned and aware as we are now in Harford County. I think it's pitching in to do its share to try to help people.
How did all this work affect you? Was it an optimistic feeling or a pessimistic, or were there good days and bad days?
Yeah, good days and bad days. Well, I guess as a school counselor, I met wonderful, exciting, uplifting things, and then experiences that were the downers, the tragedies, the children that you wanted so desperately to do something for, and yet you fell short. And I remember when I was taking my guidance work, one of the professors admonished us that we had to get a proper perspective on these things, because you could become depressed and useless if you just let every situation weigh you down. And he wasn't implying that you wouldn't be concerned, but you had to put it in proper perspective so you could do your best. And I think that's true with social work. And of course, I'm not a social worker. I was a volunteer. But I, and talking with social workers at the Department of Social Services, we talked about that. And they would say, there were times they would meet situations that just, you felt devastated by them. And you had to, you carried it home. You can't help it. You're human, and you think about it. And you wonder, what can I do, or what resource can I refer them to? So you think about it, but if you're going to become depressed, then you really don't belong there, because that's not being helpful. But because I had been a resident of Harford County for a long time, I knew resources. That's the thing I find working out at the department here in Baltimore County. I don't have my finger on resources here like I did there. Somebody will come in and I think, boy, is this from Harford County? I'd pick up the phone. And I'm learning my way, but it's a bigger county, too. It's more difficult. So I told you that I started to volunteer at Falston Hospital, and I did not find that as stimulating as working with the Department of Social Services, and gradually I dropped that, and because there were some times when we were doing the homeless shelter program, while I was to go in 2 days a week, it would be involved, and I would go in other days too to keep up with the work and that kind of thing. Then I did not take a day a month, but I was a substitute. A friend of mine, Clara Huffington, who lives in Rowling Green, and I were substitutes for Meals on Wheels. And that is a wonderful project that keeps people in their homes And it was interesting. We would, I told you that after I retired, I didn't want to have a minute left. And I did pack Meals on Wheels for a little while. But I found that going out to deliver them, again, I guess because I'm a people person, I enjoyed more getting into the home to talk a little bit, and it was more interesting to me, and I enjoyed doing that.
Can you tell me about some of the individuals you met that you worked with in Meals on Wheels or in your volunteer work at the social services?
And what do you mean by individuals? Well, employees or case people?
Cases, yeah.
Oh, yes. In the Department of Social Services, Project Independence came into being. And Kathy Lay was in charge of that. Her desk was across from mine. And she would have people come in and she would refer them to me that might need help. And some of those women that I met, they were just so determined that they were going to succeed. And I can think of a couple. One young girl who had a small child was going to Harford Community College. She had started at Temple University and had gotten a loan, had not paid that loan back, wanted to start at Harford, and they would not give her a loan at Harford because she hadn't paid the other. And when I met her, she was in the process of trying to work out something with Temple, and they did work it out that if she paid so much a month, they would release her transcript to Harford, and so that the credits could be used toward her degree. She wanted to become a registered nurse. And she came in need of rent, and we were able to help her at that point. And then she needed help with BG&E. And I got her some help there. I got my church interested, my women's association. They gave her some help. Her teeth, she had an abscessed tooth that was just awful. So I called my dentist, Charles Morris, and he agreed to take her and not charge her anything. And he said that her teeth were in terrible condition and she needed a lot of work done. Well, I would kind of, it was a thread. I would see her and I'd lose her, I'd see her and I'd lose her. And after I moved down here, Kathy Lay came down to see me and she said, "Do you remember?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "She wanted me to tell you," because she had told her that she was coming to see me. She said, "Be sure and tell Mrs. Allen that I've been accepted in the RN program." Oh, that just was so exciting to me that she was plugging along. And Charles Morris, the dentist, said that when she first started coming in, she was very almost negative. You know, I can understand how she felt. And he worked out something. He was charging her very, very little. And he was putting her mouth in order. And she was coming in, and he said she was becoming very pleasant and very friendly. And I guess together they had worked out in a relationship. But, you know, I can understand her reserve and her almost negative feeling, because she was having to growl, grope big, and that was not a nice thing to have to do. Then I can think of another woman who wanted so much to become a registered nurse. And every time the car insurance came, she had a problem. She said she was eking out an existence, and she had to have this car to get to work. And that was another thing. This other girl had a car. Same problem. I got Al Cartanuta at the Citco place there in Churchville. He worked on her car. And that was where my church came in. I couldn't think how we worked that. The church helped to pay some of the repairs on the car, and Al didn't charge much to get it fixed because these cars were their lifeline. If they didn't have a car, they couldn't do it. And this girl had to have her car, and it was the car insurance was big. And I, again, my church, those women were wonderful. I would go and plead my case, and they would say how much, and oh, they're dears. And that was another woman that sent word to me. She went into the practical nursing program because she wasn't able to swing right at that moment, getting into the RN, and then she got moved over into the RN and should be graduated now. Another woman came in, and some of the houses, the apartments, their absentee landlords, you know, they buy up these apartment buildings and they live in Timbuktu. And some of these apartments have electric heat. Well, they're expensive and they're not insulated properly. And a lady came in to see me one time, and she was always, her bill was high, and she said, it's just dreadful, the problems. And I said, maybe you need to talk with people in your legislature and discuss it with them. And I walked into the reception room one day, and she said, oh, Mrs. Allen, I want to tell you, I have an appointment. A group of us are going to meet with, I think it was Helen Bentley, the next day. And I thought, these are people that are down on their luck, but they are go-getters. They want to do their best. So they were exciting people. That in Meals on Wheels, we went over to that low-income housing place across from Citizens Nursing Home, and there was a blind man there. He had been a jockey, and we would take the food in and have a chat with him and set things out so that he could manage them. And he had to get in finally to the nursing home, and he wasn't there long until he died. And he had some niece, I guess, or nephew, something, that wrote to Meals on Wheels to thank the ladies for their kindnesses to him. And then there was a man that had only one leg that we would go to, and he was very artistic. And he did some artwork for our church one time. Those were interesting connections, because they're people with feeling and caring. A lady that was so neat as a pin and blind. How she did it, I'll never know. And when we deliver her food, she had her little table set with her silverware out and her napkin and her placemat, and just lovely, and lived in above the inhabited grace, above where the, is it the mail order for Montgomery Wards or something like that? Anyway, the places along there, the apartments are terrible, but her apartment was neat as a pin. And before she died, she was able to get over to the St. John's Towers, is that? The low income there, run by the Episcopal Church. And of course, it was just as neat, but it was nice to see her get into something that was better, because they were, that's the human element.
So what are the two biggest changes you saw in Harford County, the best one and the worst one, the time you were there?
The worst, I guess, is knowing that we are having more problems with homeless people, the very poor, that some of our young people are into drugs. Those are the social problems that, while they may not be by any means as bad as someplace else, I just felt always grieved that it was happening to our wonderful county. We have to be realistic in that slight. Those I see as some of the tragic things that are happening. What are some of the best? I guess I'd have to say losing our beautiful farmland is bad. I can't class it as worse because we've gotten lovely homes and have brought in exciting and interesting people into our county. So I have to balance that, but it does make you feel sad to go through and see all this beautiful farmland. Now, the old gentleman that came in, he likes to go out to Harford County. It's new and fresh. He's never been there. And he says, oh, to see all these trees. He's from the Middle West where it's flat and kind of barren. The trees in Harford County, the beauty of Harford County. And I agree. It is beautiful. I think to have the Susquehanna, what's that farm?
Stepping Stone.
So exciting because that's keeping our culture, our history alive. And while for me to go there and see an old churn or a horse collar, when I was a kid, I saw that. I knew it. But your children won't know what an old churn is or a horse collar, so it'll be exciting for them to remember that. How to grind corn into meal. Those are the exciting things that have happened in Harford County. And I think the good thing is that we are rising to the situation. I said that we have homeless, we have needs, and I think the people of the county are rising to that and addressing those needs. That's one of the good things, that we have not stayed the provincial little community, delightful though it was in 1945, we have been able to hold on to some of the beautiful character that we had and accept some of the new along with it.
And I think that's a terrific place to end. Thank you very much, Mrs. Allen. Here.